All right. Hey, guys. My name is Anthony Bandiero, attorney and senior legal instructor with Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training. This is the Search and Seizure Show. John Ween just did a webinar on airport and border searches. He's also a senior legal instructor for Blue to Gold. John, introduce yourself, please.
Hello, everybody. John Ween, attorney and senior legal instructor with Blue to Gold Law Enforcement Training. Happy to be here.
So I'm going to be asking, steering the ship a little bit for the Search and Seizure Show, because I actually have questions for John, and I want John to be on the receiving end of my questions versus him asking me, because I got some good questions for him. All right, guys. So here's how this works. Okay. I'm broadcasting, as you can, you know, kind of tell from a hotel in Texas, and John is in his studio in Arizona. And so if you guys have questions, the way we want to do this is if you have any questions, search and seizure questions, or something that you want to follow up on what John just taught you, just say, hey, I got a question. We can turn on your mic. We don't have the capability to turn on your camera. So don't worry about that. You can be buck naked if you want to, but just as long as your voice box works, that's all we need. Okay. Okay, so let's kick this off. But if you do have a question, say me. The live questions are the priority, but I still, regardless, I have a couple questions on my iPad here as well. All right, anything else? Did I miss anything else, John, before we kick this off?
No, I think we got Emmanuel indicated that he's got questions.
Oh, cool. Let's start off with the Emmanuel. And by the way, I was laughing a little bit. How do you say that device that you walk through that detects metal at the airport? What do you call that thing?
Magnetometer?
I don't think you call it the magnet. I think it's magnetometer. Isn't that magnetometer. Angela, you're my expert. Isn't it called a magnetometer? Is that how you say it, or is it John saying it correctly?
Right.
I've never heard it said
phonetically.
Okay, Mike Brave is saying that. Because I got to tell you, right, this is so good.
Say it again.
Magnetometer, right? And I just got to tell you, because you went to Pepperdine and I went to Gonzaga, actually, it's really what it, and I can barely spell my own name.
Right.
And I finally, and you were actually using some very big words tonight. And I was like, it was kind of good, because you know you're more refined than I am, and so when you said that, I had to bust your chops a little bit.
Yeah, so I know how to say hardness, and you know how to say magnetometer.
Yes. Hey, just so you know, though, I did because you did correct me on hardiness. I have corrected myself in my classes, just so you know. I'm not saying Jardines anymore, because it's not correct.
All right. I'm glad. That makes me...
Oh, magnetometer. Yeah, not magnetometer. Magnetometer.
Magnetometer. All right. So, you know what? The next time I need to say that word in my life, I'll know how to say it correctly.
I love it. Hey, Emmanuel, what you got for us, my friend?
Hey, how's it going?
Good, man.
I actually got three questions, but I'm trying to decide which one... two of them might be quick. One's probably like a little longer, okay. But I'm not trying to be selfish. I'll go with this one.
Okay.
Our agency, when you the policy in our agency on canine scans states two things. One, that you will tell your canine handler that responds your reasonable suspicion. And two, that you cannot ask consent to search even if you have a canine alert, or vice versa. Like, if you ask consent, you cannot also call for a canine. That's just what the policy says.
Yep.
Our canine handlers say, do not tell us anything. You call us. It is your job to articulate reasonable suspicion. We don't want to know anything because of the fear. And I guess the question is, the fear is telling your canine handler your reasonable suspicion, like a way for the defense attorney to argue, oh, you told the canine handler what you got, so therefore he definitely made his dog alert.
Oh, I see. The cueing issues, you know. Okay, let's talk about this consent issue first. John, what are your thoughts on that? You know, it's one or the other, or do you think both are in play?
So I'm struggling with this concept. He's saying like the policy is saying that you, if you have reasonable suspicion, don't ask for consent. If you have consent, don't make a reason.
I think it's one or the other, right, Emmanuel? Isn't it one of, you have to pick one?
So our policy states, then again, it's our policy, it states that if you ask the operator or owner of the vehicle for consent to search and they consent and say, yes, I agree, you cannot then call for a canine, meaning like, because I know a lot of like interdiction officers or like, you know, they'll ask for consent and also call for the canine. So then they have, it'll be like two things to argue in court. Like, oh, you didn't have valid consent. Oh, but we had a canine alert, you know?
All right. I think I'm seeing the bewilderment on John's face too, because here, let me just make sure we got this right, because I'm a little confused too. If what happens, okay, you ask the driver for consent. Now, are you asking the driver for consent to run that canine around the car? Or are you saying, hey, can I search your car for drugs?
Can I search your car for drugs?
And then we're still going to call the canine? Like the guy's going to, you know, wait. See, that seems kind of weird, because I can tell you, John's going to jump in on this, but I can tell you that that's a problem, because the canine, like when you ask for consent to search, the scope of the search should include a canine if that's what you're looking to do. So in other words, if you say, hey, can I search a car for drugs, and you don't even search it, and you just wait for that canine, he may not have even agreed to have that dog. I'm sorry, to have that dog sniff the car. That's an issue, right? What is the scope of search? What would a reasonable person believe? If they're not, in other words, if they're never told, hey, can I run this dog around your car and wait for 5 minutes before it gets here, that may not actually be valid consent. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's kind of weird, right? John, anything to add to that?
So yeah, I'm struggling with it, because always like when I see weird things in policy like this, I say like, what is the point? Like what legal direction were they given that they implemented this policy? Is it something like we're trying to not use the dogs? Is it trying that we're not like we're trying to not undermine the dogs? The reliability of the dog. We're basically saying don't stack your justifications.
Which we don't teach here at Blue to Gold. We teach at Blue to Gold, we teach stack justifications. We like multiple reasons to search. Yeah. We like having the motor vehicle exception and consent. It's something to be confident in, because you can be like, well, why would you ask for consent if you have probable cause? Because I want multiple reasons to do what I'm doing. Number one, it can give me a broader scope of search. Number two, it gives the prosecutor another reason to justify my actions. Number three, it's part of community relations, you know, getting their buy-in and what I'm doing. But you get my point. So, John, this is my intuition on this. And it's not – I have seen, and you have too, right? I've seen where agencies don't want you asking for – agencies don't want you asking for consent sometimes. And then they say no. And they say, okay, fine, I'll call the dog. And then they change their minds. I know some people don't like that. Like, then you still search. But this doesn't seem like that. This is kind of a weird one. I've never heard of a policy – telling you that you, I don't know. This is weird.
Yeah, tell me. We have Power DMS, the great almighty Power DMS. So
yeah,
some of the policies I've read, I pointed out that this is completely like unconstitutional. But anyways, not trying to pull any agency on blast.
No, that's okay. No. You know, in constitutional, unconstitutional, or just a weird policy. But let's move on. So the first thing is. Okay, we know that you can ask for consent, and if they deny consent, you can call the canine. There's no problem there. We agree with that, right, Emmanuel?
Yes.
Okay, and that's probably a good move, by the way. You know, you probably should ask for consent and just get this thing over with versus calling the canine up. Let's talk about this next issue, which is not telling the canine handler the reason for the reasonable suspicion. John, your thoughts?
So I'm good with it, and I'm siding with the canine officers here. I just kind of think it's funny that they're showing up and saying, violate policy, do not tell me what your grounds is for reasonable suspicion, right? And the reason why they don't want to know, I understand, is because they want to take away that defense argument that the only reason why the dog indicated where he did was because the handler had that knowledge that you saw or smelled, or you got abnormal nervousness, whatever it was, off that front seat passenger. And then lo and behold, you told the handler that. And then guess what? The canine alerted right there, right? And really, at the end of the day, what you know will ultimately be imparted to the canine handler, right? Under the collective knowledge doctrine or the fellow officer rule, it's AKA the fellow officer rule. So really, if you know, if you have RS, then it's like the canine handler has RS as well. And as long as you are articulating it effectively, your knowledge will be imputed to them so they can run the dog. They're not going to be running afoul of Rodriguez by prolonging the stop if you have that RS.
Okay. That's cool. All right. Another question, Emmanuel, or are we good?
I'm sorry. I might have. I think I'm a little confused. So it's fine that we're not telling our canine handler the reasonable suspicion, right? Just call the dog. Hey, alert. Hey, alert. Hey, good to go. You're saying that it's regardless, it's the collective knowledge doctrine.
No. This wouldn't be the collective knowledge in this case because you're not. Well, I'm sorry. It is the collective knowledge doctrine. We call it horizontal collective knowledge. But look, that's kind of getting. You know, we can explain what that means. But at the end of the day, there's no constitutional requirement that the canine handler know what your reasonable suspicion is. And at the end of the day, the only one that needs to really testify to a reasonable suspicion is the primary officer, which is what John's saying. We don't need to drag in the handler. If we have reasonable suspicion and your primary officer that called the handler convinces the court they had reasonable suspicion for narcotic activity, you know, then the handler does his thing. I mean, that's as simple as that. And that reasonable suspicion is imputed to the handler. In other words, it's presumed that if the primary officer has reasonable suspicion, they have reasonable suspicion, even though they don't know exactly what that reasonable suspicion is. So the community or the collective knowledge doctrine comes in, or the fellow officer rule. Like east of the Mississippi seems to be the fellow officer rule. West is collective knowledge. But anyway, that's just a legal doctrine that will save the handler from doing what he or she's doing.
Got it.
Kind of weird. Okay. Okay. Cool. All right. Good stuff. All right. So Angela says, after talking to TSA, I was told that passengers give consent to search as soon as they purchase a ticket. Is that correct? Well, John, right, taught that, right? That first of all, let's back up. Earlier cases in from the 70s, late 60s, you know, mainly the 70s when the hijackings were really at their apex, they said that going through a passenger's luggage was basically consent, that they bought their ticket or they saw the signs, you know, that people can be searched and so forth, that it was a form of consent. But the problem is that started falling apart in the 1990s when courts were challenged, like, well, consent, and if it's truly consent, that means you can revoke or modify the consent at any time. If you can't modify or revoke the consent, it's not consent, it's coercion, right? So then they started saying, hey, it's not consent. It's consent. Yes. I guess when you buy your ticket, you're like, hey, just so you know, it says on the back that all luggage is subject to screening. So if you want this ticket, if you don't want to ride Greyhound and you want to ride the Greyhound of the skies, i.e. Southwest, you're going to have to agree to search. But then when you go to that point of no return or the point of no exit, which is either the sign, you know, that sign, or it's submitting your ID. At that point, it's no longer consent. The government takes you, it grabs you with the tentacles of the special needs doctrine. In other words, we got to have a way to search this guy's bag, even if he says, you know what, I want to turn around and leave. It's not consent anymore. It's the compelling interest of airline travel or, you know, air safety. So that's so Angela, yes, it is consensual at first. Just like driving your car towards a DUI checkpoint is consensual to some degree. But once you are close enough, you're going to be stopped regardless of your consent. You can't just keep on driving. They're going to stop you and they're going to talk to you and they're going to see if you're intoxicated. That is the special needs doctrine. And same with courthouse inspections and business inspections for health inspections and so forth. Michael, can you come on the mic real quick? We really want to answer these questions live. John, do you have anything to add on that before I ask you a question?
Nope, we're good.
All right, this question, Mike, please, hopefully you'll be cool with coming on the mic. But in the meantime, let me ask John a question. John, this comes from an officer in Tennessee. He says, is there any clear definition or guidelines of when a guest, right, Cousin Eddie, right, Christmas vacation, Cousin Eddie, becomes a resident or a tenant? Example, a person tells a friend, hey, yeah, you can come crash on the couch for a few days till you get things figured out. At what point does it become an eviction process to get the person removed versus they are a guest and they can be told to leave, you know, on a whim, right? Just, hey, beat it, right? You bother me, you snore, or you're eating on my food. I can't find anything clear in Tennessee code or any type of case law. The officer does recognize that he's not sure this is a search and seizure question, but here's the deal. First of all, I think we can both agree, John, when we answer this, that we have not researched this, okay? And nor can we, because we don't have time, unfortunately, to research statutory issues like this. But I do have some advice on this. I have some guidance here, you know, what I think states are kind of looking for, with at least I know in Nevada. Do you have any, do you get these questions in your class sometimes?
Well, and I can tell you the answer in Arizona, right? And that's
okay. And I can say the answer in Nevada. Let me see if they're the same. So what's the answer in Arizona?
So the Landlord-Tenant Act in Arizona says if you have any kind of a contractual agreement, meaning you stay here this long in exchange for this, right? If there is some kind of valuable consideration, if there is some kind of deal worked out. So if the person says, hey, you stay here for a week and buy groceries, even if the person never buys groceries, we now have a contractual agreement.
The only problem with that definition, which is absolutely correct, I think in every state, I think we can safely say that, you know, any kind of contractual agreement would develop a tenancy. But there is something called a tenancy at will, which is when you don't have a contract and you just have this agreement. So in Nevada, this is based on case law, by the way, right? This is case law. This is not statutory. But in Nevada, there are cases that talk about when you let somebody into your home and the agreement is that they are going to basically say indefinitely, right? Hey, the classic example, I think, maybe classic to me at least, is, hey, friends, ex-wife, whatever, you need to get back on your feet. I'll help you. Come to my house. You know, help when you can. You don't have to have money, by the way, for tenancy at will. It's the agreement that we're looking for. Come into the house, get back on your feet, stay as long as you need to. That in Nevada, that creates a tenant. And that person cannot be evicted without a 10-day notice. It actually turns into sometimes more than that. So that's the problem with these cases, though, right? Is because my cops in Nevada do not know, they're not lawyers, right? Except you were a cop and a lawyer, but they're not lawyers for the most part. So they don't know what tenancy at will is. So here's what I teach, generally speaking. Just I kind of push this on the shoulders of the sergeant, which you were, right? I'm like, at the end of the day, if you go to a residence, this is my advice to my Tennessee cop. This is kind of like what I would think. If you go to a residence and it's like you can tell that, or you have reason to believe that they were like, hey, stay here indefinitely, no precise time, right? It's not like Cousin Eddie. Remember, Cousin Eddie said he was leaving the next month, right? So Cousin Eddie is a guest and he can be revoked at any time. You would agree with that, John? As a guest can overstay their welcome at any time. Like you're eating on my food or your dog is going to the trash, right? Yeah. But a tenant cannot be revoked at will. You have to go through the eviction process. And the reason why, there's a huge public policy reason, statutorily and by case law, it says we do not want to create homelessness where people think that they're going to be living here indefinitely. Then they have a spat. And next thing you know, beat it, right? So I had a search and seizure instructor that works in Nevada. He told cops, hey, if you don't have anything in writing, they can the leaseholder can like kick people out. So he said, and this is crazy, but he said, for example, you have a girlfriend living with her boyfriend for 2 years, but she doesn't pay rent and she doesn't have a lease. They get into an argument. He says, beat it. He said the cops can help evict her immediately. And that is not the law. Not in Nevada. because it's a tenancy at will.
Really bad practice.
It really is bad practice. Really, and so the reason I bring this up is because, quite frankly, with these like tricky issues, that's why we have these disclaimers that if you don't really know what the answer is, which you probably don't, put it on the shoulders of the sergeant and let them make the decision. Because if we get sued on this, let them go to court. I mean, it's true though. That's why they're a supervisor. Let them make the decision. And, you know, that we don't know. And maybe they have different knowledge or different experience. So that's my answer there. If they look like a tenant, like, you know, they're staying there indefinitely, I would be very careful. You might want to have eviction orders. Yep. Would you agree with that overall, John? That's kind of good advice.
100%. Best practices. If it looks like they're living there, be very
careful. That's right. Yep. Be very, very careful. Even if, Mike, you there?
I am.
Sorry about that diatribe that we're going through. I just wanted to kind of work out that question. What state are you in?
I'm out in California here tonight. And nice. At least my part of it's not burning down.
I didn't actually know California was on fire before, besides at the legislature. So, which is always the dumpster fire at that place. So,
yes, it is.
What you got, my friend?
So my specific question is this. I'm wondering kind of where are some limits I can work a little bit better in identifying passengers. I've noticed in more recent, like the last few months, it wasn't really occurring in recent years, but just like since the beginning of the year, I've noticed more and more passengers, when I ask for identifications, go, nope, I'm not going to do that and I don't have to. And so far, I've been kind of getting by with, all right, I understand what you're saying, but you know, there is case law that supports my ability to identify people inside a vehicle. And that sort of, that seems to be working for me so far. Most people they kind of look at me for a second, like, do I really know what I'm talking about? And then they'll hand over their identification. I ID them and I move on. And I've only had one instance here recently where it almost went to a resisting arrest because the person didn't want to identify. And at that point, I mean, I was on the stop. I had officers from a neighboring agency assisting me, and it was on a DUI stop. So, you know, I wanted to get the passengers out of the vehicle because the vehicle was getting towed, and I wanted them to, you know, to kick rocks and get down the road if they weren't going to identify, because I didn't want them in my traffic scene. So I'm just kind of looking where are my limits, and is there any other case law currently floating around that could help me better?
Oh, there's a case. There's a case. Well, there's a case directly on this point. It's actually not in your favor. It actually says the opposite. And it's from the Ninth Circuit called Landros. Remember Landros, John? Or you want me to explain that case?
Yeah, you explain Landros.
So Landros is from a state that makes the worst case law. What state is that, John? So I just want to hear you say it. Can you just say it? Just be honest with yourself. You don't have to be embarrassed.
Washington.
Okay, it's called Arizona.
No, and Washington.
So what happened, which obviously is the Ninth Circus, and what happened there is an officer demanded, he had a car stop. There was, you know, it's one of these cases where actually the officer did the right thing. He just did not know how to articulate it, which is a common thing we talk about all the time at Blue to Gold. So in essence, Mike, the Landros was a passenger in a car. The driver was an adult, but there were two or three teenage girls in the back of the car, in the back seat, and they were intoxicated, okay? The officer then asked Landros, the passenger, for his ID. Landros did not want to identify himself because he says he's done nothing wrong. The officer then essentially arrests him for obstruction for failing to ID. And when they got him out, they found alcohol under his legs. They did not know he had alcohol. And they got him for contributing to a minor and the obstruction. The Ninth Circuit said, hey, look, you can't arrest people. You cannot arrest a passenger simply because they are refusing to identify themselves. They have done nothing wrong. So that's the baseline law here, right? However, can you see that the cop actually had reasonable suspicion to identify everybody in the car because they're committing, right, John? I mean, it's clear as day. Like, I mean, you have drunk girls in the back seat, teenagers, or, you know, and is there a reasonable suspicion that Landros, the pastor, contributed to their delinquency? Absolutely.
Yeah, or probable cause.
Or even probable cause. Yeah. And so instead of going to court and saying that, he basically said, his mentality was, look, I have the right under Arizona law to identify people because we have a stop and identify statute. Well, it gets more complicated for California because you've got PC 148, but you don't have a stop and identify statute in California. Even right. if the person is reasonable suspicion, they don't have to identify themselves. They can't lie to you. They can't open their mouth and say they're somebody who they're not. That would be PC for a crime, but they don't have to. So here's the thing. So not only do we have Landros as a basic case in the Ninth Circuit says you cannot demand ID from passengers unless you have reasonable suspicion, you also don't have a stop and identify statute in California. So I would be very careful in California with the like demanding any kind of ID from a passenger because, you know, quite frankly, if they sue you, if they do handle their ID, they can strictly speaking say you violated my rights because you gave me an unlawful order or whatever. I'm not sure how that'll play out in a civil suit, but the point is you got very limited options. If you want them to leave, they can leave. But if they don't want to identify themselves, they don't have to.
Gotcha. That works.
Okay. Anything else?
I could probably think of a million things, but that's okay. Kind of my header issue right now.
Okay, I'm glad we worked that out because that's an excellent question. We get it all the time from California cops. Keep up the good work, my friend, and thank you for coming on. I appreciate you, man. Thank you. Okay, so next question I have for you, John, is this: we have a cop from Illinois. Okay, so they're second place for making bad case law. So don't feel too bad. Okay, can you photograph a scene prior to obtaining a search warrant? So here's kind of. Police respond to a call of a victim shot inside a home. Police enter the home, attempt to render aid and clear the scene. The victim is deceased, right? Police secure the scene while waiting for a search warrant. An evidence technician, okay. I actually didn't, I might have missed this part because I thought I had the answer, but now we have a monkey wrench in this. An evidence technician, a CSI person, photographs a scene while waiting for the search warrant. No physical search takes place, just the photographs. What do you think, John?
Okay, so do you want to do it with the CSI person or without the CSI person?
I want to do it with the CSI person, and then we're going to do it without the CSI person. We're going to do it both ways. But the answer might be the same either way. There's a monkey wrench in here, especially with CSI.
Right. So the issue is, right, you're entering, you're lawfully inside the house under the emergency aid doctrine, right?
Yeah.
Objectively reasonable basis to believe that an emergency is occurring. And so I can go into that home. I can force entry into that home because I'm responding to that emergency situation. Yep. I can then do a check of the area, right? I can sweep through the house and I can check those areas that have a nexus to the emergency. Okay.
Yep.
You know, obviously if somebody is shot in this house, I have a concern and that concern is that the person who shot them is still in the house. Okay.
No, for so good. Yep.
Yep. We're going to check that area. Now I'm going to lock this bad boy down. And now I'm thinking, there's evidence of a crime, right? We got a murder that they're deceased, right? And so there's evidence of a crime. Sure. And my concern is that whoever did this might have standing to contest the legitimacy of a search in this home, right?
That's a very good way of looking at it. But at the same time, I also, you know how we are at Blue to Gold, like standing is kind of a cop-out, right? Because, you know, yeah, you win your case because you got lucky, you know? But so standing is definitely an issue, but what about just as a practice? Do you recommend the cops do this?
So I don't, because it muddies the waters, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, really, like, letter of the law, is there anything wrong with it? No, because if I'm here and like I'm observing and I've got this place locked down, my observations can be included in a search warrant affidavit. The issue is if you start bringing in that CSI person and there's this CSI person and they start taking photographs, they're gonna start searching, right? That CSI person is probably not up on their search and seizure law. They know why they're there. They know what their job is. And so they're in there, they're taking photographs, they're moving stuff, they're looking under things, they're getting the best angle, they're bringing lights in. And next thing you know, we're doing all this without a search warrant.
And well, but there is actually a monkey wrench into this. The monkey wrench is, hold on, let me tell Angela good night. I just said it. I'm going to need to type it. Good night, Angela. And I will definitely, I'm working on a class for the officers that work at the airport. And, you know, I don't know, do you have friends at Sky Harbor?
I do. Well, I take that back. I might have.
Yeah, you know, I'm just saying, like, out of all like the cops I want to be friends with, they're the ones I want to be friends with. Because, you know, there are some times when I'm like, you know, a little late. And, you know, I got to tell you, I felt like I'm going to do a scroll real quick, because I think so. I was in Las Vegas airport. You know, I teach a lot of cops in Las Vegas, and they saw me at the airport, and they walked me to my gate, like from the check-in counter where I dropped all my luggage. And they actually like gave me like the VIP, these two cops, they gave me the VIP escort, like all the way, you know, to my gate. And I like, people were looking at me thinking like, man, this guy is famous. And they said, well, he's clearly not good looking enough to be an actor, so he must be like a stockbroker or something like that. And it was actually pretty legit. So see, Angela says,
did they perp walk you, or were they escorted?
There was not a perp walk. This was not a perp walk, man. It did not come off as a perp walk. People knew that I was a baller. You know what I'm saying? There you go. They saw my grin. They saw my happiness. They saw how cool I felt. That was not a perp walk. Okay. So here, going back to my story, or not my story, but my observations, the problem here is that the CSI is most likely going to record something that the cops did not pick up on originally. Okay. So they're going to take a picture of a wall, and in that picture is going to be a bullet hole. And under when they testify, they're like, did you actually notice there's a bullet hole in that wall? No. Right. We didn't see it. And now I see it, but I didn't recognize it at the time. Did you notice there's blood splatter in the bathroom? No, I see it now, but I didn't. And that's the problem with the CSI problem, with the issue, right? They're going to record things that are not, they did not know at the time. And so now, but okay, so let me just give you two cases. I'm going to give you another case from the state that makes the worst case law. And then I'm going to give you a case called Segura. I don't know where Segura is, but so Mincy versus Arizona, right? We know that officers in Arizona, it's a 1970s case. We got to give the cops a little slack. There was a murder scene exception in Arizona, right?
Yeah.
So there was, and you know, just, you got to give them a break. I mean, that's what they were working under. So they were wrong, which again goes back to your state. So it all started with Miranda, you know, you kicked it off, you know, you kicked the hornet's nest with that one. So they went, a cop was shot and killed. They then processed that crime scene for 4 days. There's actually another kind of interesting backstory on that, right? It was actually more than 4 days. You know that? It was like 2 weeks.
Well, anyway. I know they collected like 3,000 pieces of evidence to use it.
Yeah. 300. Yeah.
It was personal.
Yeah. So then what came in though was the pictures. So they lost all the evidence they searched for, because they did not know that at the time, but all the pictures came in, because the pictures were a representation of what the cops saw when they entered the apartment with the dead cop. Right. But then we also have Segura. Segura is saying that, hey, if this is where the cops, I think it was the FBI, actually, it might have been a DA, but they entered a warehouse. They were going to get a warrant, but they entered a warehouse and saw a bunch, like a lot of marijuana, right? But they went in there, I don't know, just kind of confirm what they knew, right? But they were also going to get a warrant. So the Supreme Court said, hey, look, we're not going to suppress the evidence, because at the time of the illegal intrusion, you were going to get a warrant. I think that's what's going on here. Would you agree? Like at the end of the day, the CSI sees something that wasn't seen originally, but we were going to see it anyway. However, I think you kind of intimated towards this, is that it creates a suppression issue and it creates needless work. So yeah, I guess you don't have standing. That's going to be fine. But if somebody does have standing, it creates a needless suppression hearing, when all we should do is just wait for the paper to arrive, and then we just do it the right way. That's my advice. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Like I said, it muddies the waters, right? Because you say, what did you know at the time that you applied for the warrant, right? If we're taking those photographs and putting them in there, then it's like, did you take those photographs?
Oh.
When did you take them?
Okay. Can we talk about that real quick? Because I think that's important. Are you okay? Okay, this is a different issue. Are you okay with having a cop inside this murder scene, snapping some pics and throwing those onto the warrant? As that's the different issue, isn't it? Are you okay with that?
I mean, I think the argument that I would make is that's a better representation of the observations that they're making.
I 100% agree. In fact, I think that's what I think judges want to see it. I think judges like that kind of stuff. It gives us context, but it just, you know, maybe it helps, maybe it doesn't help. Like a meth lab, John, right? You say, hey, while in this house, you know, for domestic, We did a protective sweep for these reasons, and we saw a meth lab in plain view. I think it's great. I think it's absolutely fantastic to show the judge, what do you mean by meth lab? You know, you say a bucket here, a beaker there. How do we know it's not a science project, right? But look, Your Honor, this is not a science project. This looks like a clandestine operation.
But what's the ASPCA case where they're doing there for the dog fighting and they open the refrigerator and start taking CSI style photos?
Oh yeah. Yeah. They lost that actually. They lost that case.
Yeah, because
and it waters. It muddies the waters, but also I don't know if they I think the problem one of the problems in that case is that it wasn't necessarily a foregone conclusion that they were actually going to search the refrigerator.
Well, and then I think the issue was what, like the photographs that came in, like we couldn't separate in the affidavit.
Oh yeah.
What was valid and what was actually the result of a search.
That's a great point. Now, again, if you can prove in court that the photographs you took were going to be taken anyway, that should be Segura. You should not lose that. However, if you exceed that scope, and that's what you're talking about, where the CSI agent, you know, officer does not really know the case law like you do or the cops do, they probably are going to be opening up refrigerators when maybe that's not in the scope of a dog fighting case, whatever that was, like a, you know, what do you call it? The animal cruelty case, but the dog fighting. Okay, good. So here's just to summarize. I don't want to be confusing about this. Summarize that we are okay with taking pictures that are representative for the search warrant to include them, but don't take CSI type photos. In fact, when I teach CSI case law, I say don't do it. Okay, muddies the waters. So this is a Leosa case. Leosa question. How good are you with Leosa?
Only as good as what I learned from you.
Okay, let me see if you can answer this. Let me see if I taught you well, my friend, because oh, yeah. I love Leosa. Are you up to date on your Leosa?
As far as I know. Oh, I mean, yes. Me personally, yes.
Okay, right. You mean, no, I'm talking about personally. You yes. Have, you qual every year?
Yes.
Can I ask you where you qual at?
Outdoor range with some guys from my old agency.
Is it a police, like, is it the police department doing the qual, or are you paying money out of your own pocket or what?
I am doing it with friends who are certified law enforcement.
Range masters. Exactly.
Yep.
Okay. Just curious. Okay. And so I don't carry that much when I travel, and you don't either, because it's a huge pain in the butt to travel with a gun. But
yeah.
This officer, huh?
Especially the small airports.
Oh my God. It's absolutely. This officer is from New York. Well, not New York. Let me see. Okay. He says New York, but anyway, it's a retired officer. He says, I'm in compliance with Leosa, just like you, John. He qualifies every single year, and I want to travel to Connecticut to see my daughter. But my flight will land in New York. Okay. You know, so he's coming, he's probably, you know, if, you know, let's say he's coming from Florida to New York, New York to Connecticut. Is he in compliance with Leosa? Okay, I'll give you the answer. You know, with that look on your face.
He's first of all, a bag with a gun in it.
Yeah,
but is he leaving the airport? Is he carrying the firearm?
Yeah. See, that's the thing. See, first of all, okay. Let's just make sure. I don't know. That's all. That's the only question I have here. Okay. Is he? I don't know if he's even here, but if he is here, if you're here, my friend, tell me you're here so we can actually work this out. But so here's the deal. First of all, Leosa does not even cover if you check a bag and you are going through different airports. There is a federal law that I think covers a scenario, but there's a federal law that talks about, you know, flying through somewhere and you're not handling that firearm, then you have no, it's not even Leosa. It's just anybody can do that, right? If you're hunting in Maine and you are bringing, let's say, a gun that is not allowed to be in, it violates New York law, right? But it doesn't violate Maine law. It's the destination. So as long as the gun is lawful at the destination, you're fine. As long as you don't, you can do that in a car, by the way. You can drive, you can have a gun in your trunk and just as long as it's locked and so forth, and you can drive to New York City and go to Maine. You just can't take the gun out. You can't, you know, there's rules about leaving the car unattended and so forth. But at the end of the day, though, even if he did go to New York, right? Even if he's like, I'm going to stop in New York and see, you know, the tower, right? You know, one tower, I think that's what they call it, right? From 9/11, he can still take his gun with him. He can still conceal carry that firearm in New York City, despite the fact that it's going to violate various, allegedly violate various laws. Like other people can't really do that much, but because he has LEOSA. LEOSA is a notwithstanding law, meaning, okay, we don't care, state, that you don't want people carrying guns in, you know, certain places and so forth, as long as it, A, is not a government building and park and so forth, they can carry that gun. Now, private property, of course, can keep you, can keep the gun out. So you're not going to be able to carry that gun inside the museum and the tower and so forth. But I'm, but I know for a fact that NYPD will actually hold that gun for you if you're a LEOSA carrier. They'll put it into their substation. So I don't see any problem here. Either A, the gun's not coming out of its luggage, or B, even if you did stop in New York to spend a day there, you can have concealed carry as long as you're not violating some of the other rules and not under the influence and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. So, easy, I mean, one.
It preempts state law, right? Because
it does preempt. It is a preemption law.
It would be worthless if it didn't. So.
Oh, 100%. And the Chicago's and New York's and the DC's of the world would be like, it's status quo, right? It has to preempt.
Anthony, while we're talking about it, the most important thing for me with regard to LEOSA is the high cap mags. So just for people.
No, it does not cover high cap mags.
So can we hit on that for people while we're talking about LEOSA? Because I think that's the most important thing for me.
And this is my viewpoint, right? You know, there may be some people, I've asked, like, there's like I went to an NRA class about LEOSA, and the instructor, who is quite frankly, his credentials are like Mike Braves, like very, very in depth. But I asked him that question, like, what did he think? He's like, you know, I don't know. I'm like, that's the most common question we get. And he's right. So I want to know what his viewpoint. So since he didn't change my mind on anything, my viewpoint is that LEOSA covers the firearm. It's literally a defined term. Firearm means a device, you know, people expelling a cartridge with, you know, powder and so forth. It does not include the mag. I don't think a mag is a defined term. And I think the mags are covered by the Second Amendment. Right. So I'm not saying that we don't have an argument here. I think that low cap mag restrictions, these high cap mag restrictions, violate the Second Amendment, but they don't violate LEOSA, because LEOSA is the firearm and it also covers the bullets. So hollow point bullets, you can have hollow point bullets in New Jersey, which they don't allow typically. So, but the magazine requirements when I go to California, I actually bring a 10 round mag for my handgun, because I don't want a cop out there that just anti-gun, you know, taking me to jail because he thinks I'm committing a felony. So, so LEOSA, unfortunately, my viewpoint and what we teach here is that LEOSA does not cover the magazine. It covers the gun, and I comply with magazine requirements. So going to New York City is going to be a problem, right, with a high cap mag. I would not do it. It's just not worth it. It's not worth it. Most of the cops there are going to be just fine, pro Second Amendment, love, would never take a fellow cop to jail, retired or active. But there's going to be one cop out there that it was not raised right and will. Or a cop in Arizona just wants to make more bad case law. You just never know, John. You just never know.
Well, and then when the officer gets asked, why did you do that? And he says, because the law says we can. Obviously, that's the answer. That's what I teach in Arizona. I say, just say that.
Go to. Okay, we have a cop in California. This cop needs our help, actually. You ever seen Wonder Pets? You have a kid. You never seen it? There's an animal in trouble. So this cop needs our help. Okay, he says this. Can officers listen carefully, because there's a lot packed in here, but I need you to answer this, okay?
Yeah.
Can officers continue? This will be our last question, by the way, unless we have somebody who wants to get on the mic. Can officers continue to detain drivers in order to do a vehicle inventory when the only crime was a traffic infraction with a citation now issued? Is this part of the business of the stop? Can officers prevent a driver who wishes to leave to take their personal property before the inventory? So we got two issues here. One, can they be detained during the inventory? And two, can we restrict them from taking their stuff out of the car and walking away?
Yeah.
He says, a number of officers I supervise have been conducting traffic stops for minor infractions, such as expired registration. They determine the vehicle is expired more than 6 months and elect to impound the vehicle. This is a discretionary tow. They complete their citation and give it to the driver. What happens next was that the officers then use control holds to take every driver out of the vehicle and search them prior to conducting their vehicle inventories. In some cases, the officers have been detained the driver in the back of their patrol car so they can conduct their inventory, sometimes upward to 30 to 40 additional minutes. In other cases, the driver wants them to leave but wishes to get their property out. Let's imagine like a backpack, okay, or a purse, John.
Yeah.
The driver is denied the request until the officer can search a vehicle for weapons for officer safety. In all these cases, officers had no particular suspicion that the driver was armed or dangerous. The driver was compliant and was not suspected of any crimes. My concern is that the officers are prolonging their detention beyond the business of the stop, and in some cases, making the detentions more intrusive because the driver could have a weapon or do something while the driver conducts while the officer conducts the inventory. You know, he wants to make sure that his cops are getting it right. So let's answer the first question. Emmanuel, you're on deck next. Well, the first question is, can we detain these drivers while the inventory is being conducted?
No.
Okay, why not?
Because the traffic stop is over, right? And so you say, what is the tolerable duration of a traffic stop? Tolerable duration of a traffic stop is, number one, be reasonable, right? So how do we define reasonableness? Well, how long does it take to accomplish the mission of the traffic stop? And so if you are telling me that they have their paperwork, they've got their citation, that I'm done with them, then like we say, you've got the ice cube, right? How big mm-hmm. your ice cube is depends on what you stop that vehicle for. You stop that vehicle for DUI, you got a pretty darn big ice cube. You stop that vehicle for failure to maintain, I mean, I don't know, failed a signal, right? You got a pretty small ice cube. So tolerable duration of a traffic stop under Rodriguez versus US is how long does it take to accomplish the mission of the traffic stop? In this hypothetical, the question is, we've given them their stuff back. They are free to go. That ice cube has melted, and now I'm just doing an administrative, safekeeping, community caretaking inventory of this vehicle. So
I agree. I agree. I mean, you know, why? Look, I don't see. I've never seen a case on this actually. Not in the criminal realm, because I don't think you get out of it in the criminal realm. At the end of the day, you have inevitable discovery, right? Even if you have a de facto arrest, you have inevitable discovery. So I don't think you get out of the criminal mess, but you could sue this officer for a de facto arrest. At the same time, it's still a constitutional issue. But why, especially John, like being cuffed and maybe not cuffed, but stuffed in the back of a police car, and also this whole like, do you have a problem with like just getting these people out and start patting them down? I mean, because their registration is expired by 6 months. Do you have a problem with that, John?
Yes, that's absolutely a violation of the Fourth Amendment.
I mean, why are we putting hands on people? I mean, you know, I think sometimes I'm, you know, just since we're talking about this, I think sometimes officers forget that when they do things, it's routine for them, right? Putting hands on people is what it is, right? But have you ever been patted down?
No. I mean, TSA.
Right. I have. I remember when I was 21 or 22, I had my car broken. And I'm bringing this is there's a reason for the story, but I had my car broken into, okay? And I've been a concealed carry holder my whole life. Right when I turned 21, I was so happy to go get my concealed weapon permit. So I lived in Las Vegas, and the area where this happened was not a crappy area, but it wasn't also great being Vegas and so forth. So two cops showed up. I can tell that one of them was a new guy, right? My intent was to be a cop one day, right? So I can tell that one of them was on training. And so I had my gun on me because I just like carrying my gun. I didn't put it away. I didn't think I had to, right? And I had my ID and my CCW, right? Concealed carry permit out. And I said, sir, also I'm carrying concealed weapon. This guy drew a gun on me. I swear to God. I'm not a, you know, I don't think I come off very dangerous to people, you know. I was like, hey, you know, I had my permit, and they patted me down and they disarmed me. And the reason I bring that up, John, is because, you know, I'm not mad or anything like that. You know, I think quite frankly, the FTO used it as a training experience, like to see how he pats people down and stuff like that. But I will never forget a stranger putting hands on me under those conditions. And now I'm just telling you, like, when the government puts hands on you, It is a big deal. That happened like 30 years ago, you know, less than that. But I still remember it like it was yesterday. It's a big deal, right, John? I mean, you have to. It's not a big deal to the cops. It's a big deal to people, and we should, as a government, make sure we're just not doing it as a matter of routine, because it's, you know, you should be able to justify why you're doing it.
Yeah.
Okay.
100%. And I think, you know, like whenever I did training and I, you know, was acting as the bad guy.
Yeah.
When you have handcuffs put on you.
Yeah.
That's a significant thing, right?
It is. You'll never forget it. Yep. People don't forget their traffic tickets. They remember every traffic they ever got. And I'm just, the reason I say this, I'm not trying to be dramatic about this. I'm not. I'm just saying, cops, when you do things that are relatively intrusive to people, just make sure you know what the law is. Like, you can't just pat people down because that's what you want to do and that's the way you do business, or I work in LAPD and that's the way LAPD does business. The law says you have to have a moderate chance of armed and dangerous. Not a lot, but it's something. And also, the case is Lopez. I want to say it's Lopez, John, but I don't quote me on it, but I think it's Lopez, where the California Supreme Court said, they reminded everybody that all inventories require good faith. Do you think there could be some pretext going on here with the flavor of what this officer is telling us, that maybe officers are using these inventories to get into cars, especially because they're not letting people go?
Yeah, 100%. And like, you're doing this for a safekeeping purpose, right? And I don't need to point to United States versus Braxton out of the 10th Circuit to talk about safekeeping, right? If I am doing this inventory for a safekeeping purpose and the person says, hey, let me take all of my stuff out of there, guess what? The best way for me to ensure that all of their property is safe is to have them pull it out and take it with them.
John, you should write a book on that, because that's exactly right. And in fact, it screams pretext to me. Okay. It screams, I'm going to tow your car, not because I would have, but I could have. And good faith requires that you would have actually, you know, towed their car, right? It's the standard is different than criminal investigations, because it's good faith, it's community caretaking. This thing screams pretext. And not letting people take their stuff out, you know, keeping them on scene for up to 40 minutes. It all sounds like a ruse to me, just to see if there's drugs in the car. And if there's not, then the guy goes. Did I lose John?
You lose me?
Well, I can't see you.
Well,
would you?
I click. What did I click on?
I don't know. So there you are. Okay. So it screens pretext. Now, I think you answered the last question. Can they take their stuff out? Look, unless the cop, would you agree, if the cop has reasonable suspicion that there's something going on here, like it could be armed and dangerous, then do what you got to do. Right, John?
Yeah.
But if not, it's communicating. It's letting him have his backpack, or, hey, please let me just grab as much stuff as I can, because, you know, I'm never going to be able to see this car again. Because a lot of people, and that's another thing too, John, a lot of people who get their car towed will never see that car again. You would agree with that. Because a lot of people were towing, if it's 6 months expired, they probably don't have that much money and they're never going to see that car again. Maybe they want their baby seat. Maybe they want their baby bag. Maybe they want their, you know, their stereo, no, their boom box. The point is, I say, my rule is this, John, you can have whatever you can take out of that car before that tow truck arrives is good to go. When that tow truck, you know, and maybe I'm being a little, you know, generous here, but basically give you a reasonable amount of time to get some stuff out. And after a reasonable amount of time, then I got to get down to business, start inventorying stuff. You agree, John?
I do. I mean, why are we in there? That's ultimately the question.
It's
if I'm in there for a valid community caretaking purpose, then that shouldn't prevent them from taking items out of there.
Yeah, I totally agree. So can you let Emmanuel, can you put his mic on? Just he'll be our last call of the day. And my officer from California, please, you're doing the right thing here to make sure your cops are not getting in trouble. You know, California is restrictive. You guys have some case law on this issue. So please make sure that, A, your cops are on the up and up on their toes. On their toes. There might be a pun in there. They're on their up and up on their toes, on their toe, you know, vehicle toes. And also, they are not restricting people from grabbing their stuff out of the car just because they don't want to. Emmanuel, you got the last question of the day. What you got?
I'm going to plug Advanced Traffic Stops real quick. That California officer, Advanced Traffic Stops, fantastic class, a whole lot of fun. I have never taught that class, and not have multiple people come up to me afterward and say, I learned so much. I've been doing this for 20 years, and maybe I haven't been doing all of this exactly right during that time. So
are you doing that class online by any chance anytime soon?
No, I got advanced search and seizure coming up, but advanced traffic stops is not on the agenda.
Okay. Oh, I'm thinking about allowing that cop to come for free.
Okay.
Because it's a great class, and it's a great question that he I love the fact that he's coming to us to help him make sure his cops are squared away, because he's actually trying to help him, not hurt him. Yep. So I'll reach out to him, John, and invite him to your class. Emmanuel, what you got?
Hey, all right. So real quick, so when you guys answer questions, like either on the YouTube or on here from other officers, and you reference cases from other circuits, but the case technically is not in that respective officer's circuit, still apply, or is it more of like an legal advice of like, hey, just letting you know, this circuit said this, your circuit might say the same thing if it comes to that point?
Man, I love this question. It is such a great question, because I'm sure that a lot of people actually have that question. John's going to answer it for you, but money question. What do you think, John?
All right. So, Manuel, basically what we've got is we've got mandatory and persuasive authority, okay? So if you say, let's say hypothetically you're working in Texas, right? Texas law controls what you can do, as does the Fifth Circuit, as does the United States Supreme Court, right? So that is your hierarchy of mandatory authority. Then we have persuasive authority, which is from other states or from other circuits, depending, okay? Basically, what that means is your hierarchy above you is not bound by those decisions necessarily from the lower courts, but they can use their rationale to reach the same conclusion or reach a different one. So it's mandatory versus persuasive authority. A lot of times when we have kind of unique issues, they may not be identified in other circuit court cases.
Right.
What we try to do when we teach in a specific state, right? Like, so I'm teaching in Arizona right now. And so I'm teaching as much Arizona specific case law as possible, as much Ninth Circuit case law as possible, and then as much United States Supreme Court case law as possible. But there are certain points that we're making that maybe there isn't a Ninth Circuit case directly on point. And so we say, well, I've got one out of the 10th Circuit, I've got one out of the 11th Circuit, I've got one out of the 4th, 7th, whatever it is. Just understand that's court's rationale. It's persuasive authority, not mandatory authority for you, but it gives you some direction.
Okay, I want to add something to that. So here's the other thing, Emmanuel, is that, you know, Blue to Gold, we're the experts in search and seizure. This is what we do. This is our passion. This is, you know, John and I, we don't really go outside our sandbox when it comes to search and seizure. And the reason I bring that up is because I have plenty of cases. Like, I have a case out of the First Circuit called French versus Morrell. And it's a phenomenal case. And I know that it's a case involving a knock and talk gone bad. But the reason I bring up that case is because I'll teach that case. You're in the Fourth Circuit, Emmanuel, because you're in Maryland, right?
Yes, that's right.
And so I'll teach that case when I go to Maryland. And the reason I teach is that, hey, this is not binding. You can ignore it if you want, but you're taking a huge risk, because Blue to Gold, our expertise is search and seizure. So we get paid to predict what your courts are going to do. And so what I say, look, if you have this same situation that occurs in your district tomorrow, I'm going to tell you that probably, you know, your courts, at least at the appellate level, right? Because, you know, trial courts are kind of, you know, some judges don't get it right. That's why we have appellate courts. But at the appellate level, hey, I'm telling you, like, they're probably going to look at a case like Morrell, you know, and they're going to say they got it right. And so because my cop in Maryland did the exact same thing last night, that's the outcome right here, which is wasn't a good outcome for the officers. And so I just want you to know that when you and all your friends, they come to Blue to Gold, they watch YouTube channel. Yes, we are talking about general law. We're talking about best practices, but we have always said around here that our advice, we feel very confident. Now, this is just training. This is not legal advice, but our training is we feel confident it's going to win at the U.S. Supreme Court. It's going to win at the circuit courts. And that's why you come here. Now, you work in a state that relatively is a Fourth Amendment state. Maryland, surprisingly how liberal they are, has not turned into a New Mexico, New Jersey, or Washington, even though I'm surprised that they haven't. But when we teach, when like John teaches a lot in Washington, when he goes to Washington, man, his whole game changes. It's very restricted there, and we have to know our game plan. But I got to tell you, that's why you notice that I ask cops like where they're from, this what state, and the reason why we're doing that is because I want to know. Okay, I can tell them that most likely this is what their course are going to be looking for. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great question. All right. Yeah, actually, Teresa is also in Maryland. That's actually a great idea. I'm definitely going to promise you. I'm going to come to Maryland in 2025 and teach a class, so we can also, let's book it. All right, Manuel. Thank you, guys. I think that's it. Any parting words, John?
Nothing from me.
I don't know, I was just gonna say, like, you got these. You're doing more and more like social media videos, by the way. And I got to tell you, like, I don't know if everybody gets your humor, but if you know John, you just laugh because he's really, you got this super dry wit, and I just hope people appreciate how funny you're at least you're trying to be. I mean, you know, you're way funnier than me, and I think that I try to be funny. You are funny. You know, but you don't push it as much as I do. All right. Thank you, John.
Some don't.
Huh?
Some people get it, some don't.
Yeah, I just wonder because your dry humor. I wonder if people in the classes are like, is this dude serious? Like, is he actually trying to be funny, or is this just some square lawyer, you know? They get you, don't they, though? They get you.
Some people start laughing, and then more people start laughing. And they're like, okay, I guess it's okay to laugh.
Yeah, it's okay to laugh. Yeah. Okay. Well, look, I appreciate you. I think you did a phenomenal job with a webinar topic that really is not sexy, but quite frankly, it's a useful information. I think a lot of people, by the way, come here on the airport topic just to see, like, what happened? Like, they just want to know, like, to themselves, like, do I have to submit to this and that, you know, and so forth. So I think it was great. So thank you so much. And I'll see you next week.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Everybody, be safe out there. If there's anything that we can do for you guys, bluetogold.com/show, submit your questions, bluetogold.com/show.
Yeah. And Emmanuel, if you want to, you work for a big agency. So if you want to bring me out next year, reach out to me at anthony@bluetogold.com or just training@bluetogold.com. All right, Emmanuel. I know you guys are, I think I've trained with your agency before. It's kind of a stupid thing to say because I think I've been out there. I got maybe anyway, we'll talk. Yeah, we have. Exactly. I've been at your agency. So we'll rebook it. All right, my friends. See you guys.